Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace. So today I'm going to show you a little bit of a quality of life improvement. You'll notice here on the archive page there's a few buttons and a bunch of text links, which is what I originally started with. But if you see now, if I go to add button, I can just type in a new title. So I'm replacing one of the text links with a new button. So I'll go into the attach link, scroll down, find the relevant web page, or I could type it in. Open a new tab, that's all done. But now I've just got a bunch of stacked buttons. I remove the old link. But what do I do with this stacked button? Well, it turns out that the system is intuitive enough. You don't have to drag the buttons around like this if you want them all on the same line. Just drag the next one up and there you go, nice and evenly spaced. Of course, you can then go in and switch the column widths around if you want them to spread out further. But in this case, I want them in a nice central column because it helps for mobile users. So I'm just going to go and put in another button. This is for British carriers. Again, same link, URL, and I can drag it up. Do I want it there? No, I think I'll put it there. And now it's in place as well. Take out that link. So that's all nice and easy. And then obviously I can go through and easily replace all the other links with much easier to access buttons. Exit, save, click on the link, make sure it works. And there you go. There's the page. All nice and easily done with Squarespace.
So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenefell. You can get a free trial, and once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show.
Propaganda, or as they call it these days, public relations and advertising. No, seriously, the old propagandists literally invented this stuff. It's used in peace and war to try and manipulate people's thinking on various topics. Sometimes it will be external, where a foreign power is trying to make the population of another country do something that population will think is good for them, but is actually good for the foreign country, usually by misrepresenting a situation. For example, if you claim that you've sunk a lot more convoys and warships than you actually have, this might make the enemy population press its leadership for peace negotiations under the thinking that they're clearly losing the war, when in fact they may not be. Propaganda of this nature can also stray somewhat into the field of intelligence and counterintelligence, as in this example, if you make plenty of aggressive public claims around the ship sunk, when all you know is that some of your units tried to attack them, you might then force the enemy government into revealing some or all of the real number of ships sunk or damaged to assuage their population, and that in turn helps you construct a better idea of the effectiveness of your attacks. But there's also internal propaganda. Now, this can be directed by a government to either try and change a population's opinion about internal matters or about an external threat. The latter can vary. Sometimes it will denigrate the foreign power or an element of that power, claiming that they're evil, immoral, or sometimes even pathetic. Other times it will present an overblown idea of the enemy's capabilities. Either way, the idea is to get the population to agree to do something about that situation. In the scope of this channel, that's usually by supporting expanded war measures or defence spending. Occasionally, when a government wants to cut costs, or more accurately, usually cut spending on public services like defence so they have more money to channel to themselves and their mates, they'll present a rather rose-tinted view of things that makes the world seem far safer than it actually is so that they can justify defence spending being reduced. Or they might over or undersell some other issue to justify diverting money there. The other form of internal propaganda is more subversive. This involves either planting or exploiting ideas and stories in the population that then grow organically and will make the population demand change, thinking that it's entirely their own idea. At which point the government can pretend to accede to the public's wishes when actually they're getting what they wanted all along. An example of this would be the various invasion scares of the late 19th century. Some were indeed organic movements that were then simply hyped up when they were noticed in order to justify increases in spending. But other times, these what we would term today call viral stories just so happened to pop up at a time when certain government departments really needed to point to some kind of external pressure or protest in order to justify the additional money they were asking for. Sometimes the propaganda has a limited effect that's really only applicable to its time period and then it's mostly forgotten about, For example, the invasion scares of the 19th century are a very good example of this, since no one seriously worried about a sudden out-of-the-blue invasion by the German army all that much after World War I, with the exception of some speculation around Operation Sea Lion, and that, even then, wasn't exactly out of the blue given the whole, you know, World War thing that had been going on for at least a year beforehand. But other times, propaganda can persist and grow far beyond the time period it was designed for, or, alternatively, more recent propaganda can, in a certain way, travel back through time as it then colours people's views of the propaganda target, even when they look back at previous historical cases. So, why have we just spent 5 minutes discussing propaganda on a naval history channel? Well, because today we're going to look at some examples of propaganda or stories that circulate today, and you'll sometimes find people parroting without really thinking about it. But when you apply even a modicum of common sense or research, you realise that the immediate implications of it beyond the most basic surface-level assertions are actually completely stupid and, in fact, often counterproductive to whatever point the speaker thinks they're actually making. So I've picked a range of examples, and then I'll explain why each one is propaganda or is very, very stupid, but feel free to add your own examples in the comments below. So we're going to start off with something that's more of a story, or at least it originally was a story, that has then grown in some quarters to the level of propaganda. And that is a very specific thing. Captain Lindemann survived the opening minutes of Bismarck's last battle. Now, as most of you are probably aware, the more common narrative is that in the opening minutes of the engagement, a shell, probably a 16-inch shell from Rodney, smashed into the conning tower of Bismarck, killed everybody inside, including Admiral Lütjens and Captain Lindemann, and from that point on, Bismarck was basically left without a command and control facility because the only one left in the line of succession was the first officer, Earls, who was down in a forward control station, and he was very rapidly cut off from communication with the rest of the ship. However, based on one or two survivors' accounts, some people claim that Captain Lindemann survived this incident and was later seen saluting the ship on the bow as it went under. And sometimes you can even see the weakness of this story right to begin with, because in many versions it doesn't even necessarily say, I saw Captain Lindemann and I knew exactly who he was. It literally comes down to, I saw a man with a white cap on, and the only person with a white cap on a German warship would be the commander. Therefore, that must have been Captain Lindemann. I mean, regardless of, you know, anti-flash hoods and stuff, which could have been pulled back anyway, getting to the point of why this is a bit of a stupid story and in a lot of ways actually counterproductive. Firstly, when Bismarck went down, she was largely on fire and rolling over, and, well, trying to hold on to a ship that's turning turtle while it's actively burning down around you is far less of a dignified exit than it might sound when you just put it as, well, he was saluting on the forecastle as the ship sank. It's rather difficult to keep your balance in those kinds of circumstances. But also, think for a moment about what we know about Lindemann. Lindemann was a far more aggressive officer than Lütjens. His service history points to a fairly competent commander, certainly in the top third, if not the top 10 percentile of German captains at the time. And yet we are supposed to believe that having miraculously survived a shell impact that killed everyone around him, or possibly did maybe he wasn't in the conning tower at the time, maybe he'd gone outside for a breather or whatever. But in any case, having survived this initial hit, and with the death of Admiral Lütjens being the senior most officer on the ship, Lindemann then watched for over an hour as his ship was shot apart around him, his crew was massacred, and his vessel, as we said earlier, was set on fire, and did absolutely nothing to try and either prevent or mitigate this. He didn't try and retake command of the ship. He didn't try and issue orders. He just left it to poor old bewildered First Officer Earls down in forward control, and the various other senior officers, Gunnery Officer Schneider having been killed as well,
and just kind of let them get on with it, and then just showed up at the very last minute to bid farewell to his ship. Not only is that completely contrary to everything we know about Lindemann up until that point in history, during his entire naval career, but it would also make him suddenly turn from one of the better German naval officers into not just one of the worst German naval officers, but one of the worst naval officers of all time, because he just completely abrogated his command responsibility right from the start of the battle and, as we said, let his crew be killed. You know, we'd be talking about an attitude that would be on a par with Cutler Beckett at near the end of Pirates of the Caribbean 3, when his three-decker flagship is somehow completely demolished by the Black Pearl and the Flying Dutchman. That's a whole other kettle of fish to open up. But that whole thing where he sees destruction coming and then just walks blank-faced along his ship while it's being blown apart around him while everyone's desperately begging him for orders, that is essentially what people would be saying Lindemann was doing if you believe this idea that he shows up at the last minute to salute the ship from the bow. And frankly, that's actually pretty insulting to Captain Lindemann, who absolutely would not have done that kind of thing. And ultimately, you know, what exactly is this supposed story trying to prove? There's generally some kind of undercurrent that essentially amounts to, ha-ha, the British didn't get him, even though you said you did. But at what cost? What, the character assassination of one of Germany's better naval officers for ego points? It makes no sense once you stop to think about it, as well as ignoring both physics and the accounts of other survivors who actually made it up to the conning tower before the ship sank. And second, although there's no particular order to these, I think, and in actual fact, if I was going to rank any of this, I would probably put this as first, would be the French, and more specifically, people's attitude to the French when it comes to, in the case of this channel, naval combat. You see, you have this whole thing of, oh yes, well, you know, the French, they cannot fight. They are the cheese-eating surrender monkeys, as was a coin termed in the early 2000s. And, well, as you might guess from that, a lot of this attitude, not all of it, admittedly, but a lot of this attitude is actually very recent, having been essentially invented by propaganda departments in the last couple of decades due to various modern political shenanigans that I'm not going to go into here. There was a certain element of it during the Cold War as well, because ultimately it all stems from France surrendering during the opening stages of World War II, but it was massively amplified in the early 2000s. And as a result, when you have a look at all sorts of commentary, whether it be about the French in the Age of Sail, the French in the 19th century, the French in World War I, and indeed the early involvement of the French in World War II, you keep seeing people going, oh, ha, ha, yes, well, you know, the French would just surrender at the drop of a hat, you know, the French can't fight, etc., etc. This is one of the most pernicious and dumbest bits of propaganda that I've seen circulating in a naval context. Because, yes, the French did surrender in 1940, and yes, there's lots of history to be made out of that, but to somehow imply that this retroactively means that France could never fight not only is fairly insulting to the French, and some people may not particularly care about that, but it's also massively, massively insulting to everyone who's ever fought France. And I think the list of people who have ended up in a war with France is probably second only to the list of people who have ended up in a war with Britain. And most of Britain's wars have usually been against France, except for in more recent periods. So let's work back in time a bit in the period this channel covers. World War II. Okay, yeah, sure. France as a whole surrenders. Does this mean that the Marine Nationale couldn't fight or didn't want to fight? Well, absolutely not. Prior to the French surrender, the Marine Nationale was perfectly willing to fight. They went out on expeditions with the Royal Navy. They fought, they died, and they bled alongside the Royal Navy in many cases. And there were French ships helping to evacuate both the British and French soldiers at Dunkirk as well. And again, they suffered for it. So that certainly wasn't a lack of a will to fight. What about
after the official French surrender to Germany? Well, again, when you actually look at the circumstances, you can divide it into the Vichy Navy and the Free French Navy. Now, with the Free French Navy, that's clearly not a lack of will to fight, because at that point you've got the theoretical successor government to the original French government, so the Vichy French government, saying, no, you need to come back to mainland France and we're kind of sitting the rest of this out. So you've got the easy out option. You've also got the majority of the Marine Nationale, although admittedly some of that is thanks to Vichy countermeasures, deciding they are not going to participate further in the war. And yet, admittedly a minority, but still a reasonable number of French officers and men decided, no, we are going to continue to fight. Some of those were from French ships that were at sea, some of those were from French ships that were already in British ports, and some of them were from French ships that were in Vichy ports and then ducked out and said, no, you know, stuff those orders, I'm going off to fight. That is not the action of a coward. And even among the forces that didn't continue on with the Free French Navy, the forces that notionally at least stayed under the Vichy flag, that it was not a uniform sentiment. I've mentioned before on the channel, the Vichy French government, that is, had to emergency fly out a bunch of officials, high officials, to replace a bunch of officials and officers in Dakar, because they were seriously worried that if the British showed up at Dakar first, which is where the battleship Richelieu had gone, along with a number of other French ships, that at that point, both the Dakar administration and the French officers might well just turn around and go, yeah, actually, we're going to fight on. Thanks for the offer. And it was quite literally a case of pack a bunch of replacements on a plane and fly them out and tell the other lot they're relieved before the British show up. Otherwise, a good chunk of our naval firepower might go off and join the Free French. Given the unreliability of long-distance flights at that point, it's a very interesting thing to speculate, if you like alternate history, what would have happened if that aircraft had crashed on the way. The officials had never arrived. Dakar and its contingent of Marine Nationale ships had joined the Free French Navy, and the battleship Richelieu had gone on to a rather gloried wartime career. But that's getting a little bit off topic. Even when you look at situations like Alexandria, and to a certain extent even Mirz el Kebir, although the evidence there is a little bit more murky due to the circumstances of that particular engagement, but definitely Alexandria, the majority of French naval personnel aboard their ships wanted to continue to fight. The slight problem was that the majority of those men were also the regular sailors, the NCOs, and some of the lower level officers. At the very upper echelons, the people who were actually in charge of the ship, so captains and the admiral, they were the ones who were more conscious of, well, theoretically, the Vichy government is the successor to our previous government, therefore we should listen to them. And they were the ones who were making the decisions, and there was enough naval discipline that even if the majority of the crew disagreed with the decisions of their senior officers, when the senior officers made a decision, they still obeyed. But all it would have taken would have been a handful of slight changes of mind in those upper echelons of officers, and big chunks of the French Navy, whether they be at Alexandria, Mirz el Kebir, or even some of the ships that were in UK ports, very well might have gone across to continue to fight under the Free French banner. So it wasn't like the Marine Nationale lacked the willingness to fight. It was more a case of the political shenanigans surrounding Vichy France and the relationship between the Vichy government and the upper echelons of the Marine Nationale, which is a very small number of men. And at that point, you can get into the, you know, the relative politics of, do you constitute the Vichy government as a legitimate government or not, and how much hindsight you're applying to all of that, etc. But now that becomes a political argument centered, as I said, on a very small group of men rather than an unwillingness on the behalf of the majority of the Marine Nationale to keep up a fight. Now, skipping back to World War One, and again, this is ignoring the war in the air and the war on land, because I'm not an air warfare or a land warfare historian, looking purely at the war at sea. And in the Mediterranean, where you had the Austro-Hungarian Navy, potentially operations by the Ottoman Navy, while the Royal Navy was present in the Mediterranean in a varying degrees of strength throughout the war, the vast majority of the naval strength present in the Mediterranean, if you look at just sheer numbers of ships, was French. And the Royal Navy, again, depending on its relative level of strength on a given year, was entirely willing to either work with or the French Navy, the Marine Nationale, or allow the Marine Nationale to take on the bulk of responsibility for securing the Mediterranean. That was one of the Empire's key lifelines in terms of trade, and as well as prestige. And that's not a task that something like the Royal Navy would give over to a navy they thought lacked fighting spirit. Wind back further to the Crimean War, when Britain and France are allied with each other against the Russians, and you find the Marine Nationale fighting alongside the Royal Navy, mostly in the Black Sea, and they plan joint operations, they carry out joint operations. There's not all that much comment or complaint either way between the two navies in terms of, you know, oh, your ship isn't supporting our ship or whatever. Both sides are making technological innovations. You know, if the French are afraid to fight, then going up against things like the Siege of Sevastopol and so forth, the Royal Navy would have made a note of it, but they don't, because the Marine Nationale isn't afraid of a fight. Wind back a little bit further to things like the big naval reviews, and the British take the threat of French sea power seriously. When the French build Gloire, the British don't go, oh yes, well, you know, they've made the funny iron ship, but you know, the French will never actually come out to fight. They don't have any serious navy, so we don't need to worry about that. No, the British go full-scale industrial revolution mega arms race, precisely because the Marine Nationale is actually a threat and they are worried about them coming out to fight if they have a slight technological edge over the existing Royal Navy fleet. Wind back still further to the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, and yes, okay, the Marine Nationale does not exactly cover itself in glory in most of the engagements of that period, but that is largely because, thanks to political considerations on land, they've beheaded or exiled a good portion of their experienced officer corps. Now, was it a particularly wise thing for the Marine Nationale to have allowed itself to drift from an actually relatively meritocratic organisation to a mostly aristocratic-dominated organisation during the 1700s? Probably not, but that is, again, nothing really to do with the willingness of the average French sailor to fight. And yes, there are terrible admirals, like Villeneuve, but there are other captains and admirals like Infernet and Magon and so forth who showed that they could fight and die just as hard as anyone else. And if you wind back still further into the sort of the classic Age of Sail, when French officers are not at risk of being beheaded because of an accident of birth, you find that the French Navy is still considered a major threat and wins considerably more victories or forces considerably more stalemates than the impression you would perhaps get from the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars for the reasons we just mentioned. And more broadly speaking, from a general arc of the Age of Sail naval history, when Britain and France are very often at odds with each other, if the French Navy lacked the will to fight and would surrender at the drop of a hat, why on earth did the Royal Navy spend the better part of 3 to 4 centuries near constantly at war with them? You know, if France's Navy can't fight very easily, then the Royal Navy should have walked in, essentially taken the entire French Navy for its own in the first 3 months of any given conflict, and that would have been the end of it. And instead, although obviously, yes, the Royal Navy does acquire a good number of French ships, particularly in the Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars, the Royal Navy is viewing these struggles as existential knockdown, drag-out fights. Not to mention the fact that the Marine Nationale, thanks to the Battle of Virginia Capes, is in large part responsible for the British losing the 13 colonies and the 13 colonies then going on to become an independent United States of America. So, from a naval context, can the French fight? Absolutely they can. They are very, very tough opponents. The fact that in the grand arc of naval struggles in the Age of Sail, they end up losing to the British doesn't make them incapable of fighting or extremely prone to surrender or any of these other pejoratives. It just means the British were slightly better. And ultimately, if you're fighting a really, really, really tough opponent and you overcome them, that means you must be really, really good. If you fight an opponent who's useless and you take ages to overcome them, then you're only, you know, one bar slightly higher on the uselessness level. So especially in the Anglosphere, if you denigrate the French in a naval context, you're actually severely denigrating the Royal Navy as well, which a lot of people don't seem to realise. Flipping things around on their head a little bit to talking up an opponent a bit too much, in, well, both land and air, but also at sea, you will sometimes consistently hear people going on and on and on and on about German technological superiority. This is largely confined to World War I and World War II due to the fact that Germany as a coherent political entity didn't exist for much of the period that the channel covers. But in World War I and World War II, you constantly hear people banging on about how the Germans were just better than everybody else technologically and so on and so forth. Usually coupled with, the Allies only ever won through sheer numbers. But from a naval perspective, this is completely and utterly ridiculous. Now, does it mean that the Germans were technologically inferior? Also, no. What it means is that Germany was a European technologically advanced power, and it was fighting initially Britain and France, other technologically advanced European powers, and then later on Russia and the US. And Germany had areas where it was more advanced technologically, but it also had areas where it was inferior technologically. And often some of these areas become more exacerbated as time goes on in prolonged conflicts, because depending on how the conflict is going and what the priorities are for the different navies, they tend to identify certain technologies for further advancement. So by the end of the Second World War, for example, Allied sonar technology was massively in advance of German sonar technology, whereas at the start of the war, particularly in the area of things like hydrophones, Germany was arguably slightly ahead. And similarly, Allied anti-submarine warfare weaponry, whether that be Hedgehog mortars, depth charges, and then later Limbo and Squid launchers, all of that was significantly further ahead than the Germans were. The flip side was that the Germans were somewhat further ahead in the realm of things like electrically powered torpedoes, homing torpedoes, submarine stealth, etc., etc. And when you stop to think about it, that isn't exactly surprising, because the Germans had lots of submarines and were desperately trying to improve the survivability and lethality thereof, and the Allies desperately wanted to improve the lethality of their anti-submarine escorts. So they both focused on those things. Now, that's not to say that the Allies didn't make certain breakthroughs in submarine technology and the Germans made certain breakthroughs in anti-submarine technology, but those advances were, comparatively speaking, lesser than the advances that they were making in the areas that really, really mattered to them. And some other things that are sometimes chalked up to technological superiority often actually just come down to certain design choices. People in World War I, for example, will like to point to German battleships and battlecruisers and go, oh, yes, well, you know, look, they were far more heavily armoured. Well, in some cases, yes. In other cases, no, but people tend to just ignore that in favour of generalisations. But even in the cases where German ships perhaps were carrying more armour than their immediate contemporaries in, let's say, the Royal Navy, because that's their biggest opponent in World War I, but then you look over it and it's like, well, in some cases, when you're looking at direct contemporaneous ships, the British ship is faster, the British ship is longer range, and perhaps more importantly in the realm of protection, the related area of firepower. Yes, the German ship might be more heavily protected, but the British ship is carrying bigger guns, which to a certain extent negate the additional protection, and similarly, the German ship is carrying smaller guns, which means that, strictly speaking, the British ship doesn't need quite as much protection. So, for example, if you're looking at the German battleships, the Kaisers and the Koenigs, with their 12-inch guns, and the British is thinking, right, we're going to fight at 15,000 yards, well, the average armour penetration of a 12-inch gun at 15,000 yards is about 10-11 inches, depending on which particular figures you believe, at which point Okay, you put a bit more armour than that on and you're fine. Whereas if the British are rolling out with a 15-inch armed battleship whose shell can punch through 13 or 14 inches of armour at a similar range, well, if you're a German ship, you're going to need that additional armour. Of course, this is assuming the British shell fuses actually work properly, but that's a separate issue. So suddenly, yeah, you've got 14 inches of armour. That's barely enough to withstand the contemporary British shell fire for the latest battleships in, say, 1913, 1914. Whereas the British, yeah, they might have a couple of inches or 1 inch less armour, depending on the ship you're looking at. But because you're flinging smaller shells at them, they've actually got a better margin of protection at this, let's say, 15,000-yard range than your heavier armour has against the heavier British shells. So that's, you know, just having thicker armour isn't a technological superior or design superiority. That's adapting to the existing situation of the other guy has massive great guns they're firing at you. And then, of course, the whole, oh, well, the Allies could only win against them with mass numbers completely falls apart in a naval context when you look at situations where either German ships are facing down Allied ships 1v1, or small group versus small group, or even cases where the Germans have managed to achieve local superiority, like, say, the Battle of the Barents Sea. The Germans massively outnumber, massively outgun the British escorts at the Battle of Barents Sea, but the Battle of Barents Sea is a thoroughly embarrassing defeat for the Germans, something which, with both a numbers and firepower advantage, along with supposed technological superiority, absolutely shouldn't have happened, but did. So the whole myth of the Germans being technologically superior in every possible way falls apart the minute you start to analyse it in even the slightest way in a naval warfare context. Now, why do I say this is propaganda? Well, it seems to originate from two places. Firstly, a certain degree of internal propaganda from Allied powers at the time, who were essentially trying to big up German technology and say, oh, look how powerful and advanced the Germans are. And therefore, by comparison, when we, because obviously this is from the perspective of the Allied powers, when we beat them, that makes us really good, because clearly we're even better than the Germans, despite the fact they have all these fancy technical gizmos. And the other aspect, as I'm sure, again, land and air historians will back me up on, is a certain amount of it comes from post-war German writings, where various German senior officers would write memoirs and articles and books and so forth. And one of the themes that they constantly try and push is, oh, yes, well, you know, we were the better army. We were better disciplined. We had better technology, etc. We, and therefore, me as the general or air marshal or admiral of this really advanced force, you know, I was a really cool person who had really cool people and really cool equipment. And yes, we lost in the end, but, you know, I'm still really cool, is essentially what those messages are. But they've been bought hook, line and sinker by a disturbingly large percentage of people. And flipping things back around on their head, but kind of maintaining touching distance to our previous point, is another one that you will sometimes see floating around, which is people turning around saying, oh yeah, well, you know, the Royal Navy's reputation is entirely overblown. Britain couldn't really ever design ships worth toffee. They kind of trail off after that, except for maybe occasional allusions to Jutland and exploding battle cruisers. But essentially, their argument goes that Britain's naval power is always very overblown because they were always going around in, you know, poorly armed, poorly equipped, poorly designed ships, and it's just a miracle that they somehow kept managing to win. And the reason I said this kind of plays into the previous point is, well, people often pair that with the Germans were technologically superior, supposedly, in World War I and World War II, and they'll go back to in places like the Age of Sail and point out that, you know, the French had 80 gunners with 36 livre cannon, whereas the British had only 74 gunners with 32 pounder cannon, and, you know, claims that the Bucentaur had a similar or greater broadside than a British first rate and therefore somehow was better, etc. And again, this falls apart on two grounds. Firstly, as we just mentioned, this is the whole thing with the Germans. We won't go over that again. Secondly, as I've covered on this channel, yes, French capital ships in the Age of Sail, especially towards the end of the 18th century, did have some design advantages in some areas over British capital ships, particularly when you're looking at third rates. Yes, the French 80 gunners carried more guns and heavier guns, and the French 74s, even if they might carry similar numbers of guns, The 36 Livre was a heavier gun than a 32 pounder. This is true, so the broadside weight was greater. But that came at a cost. You got slightly more firepower and slightly more speed, but if your crews couldn't fire as fast as the British crews, then the total weight per minute, or weight per 10 minutes of broadside, was still going to be significantly in the Royal Navy's favour. As pretty much everyone experienced to various degrees, having really heavy lower deck guns actually didn't help that much, because they caused far more problems for your own crew in terms of handling difficulties and injuries than they would ever do in marginally increased damage to the enemy. And while longer and slightly roomier French ships were quite popular in and of themselves because, well, they were bigger and roomier, they also tended to work themselves apart fairly quickly in high seas when perhaps you were on long-term blockade duty, and they're also somewhat less manoeuvrable. So again, it's not a case of Britain having technologically inferior ships, it's a case of Britain, the Royal Navy in this case, having made different choices to fulfill their needs on the high seas. And given that, especially in the age of sail, they were the ones who were out there on the high seas more often, you might have this very bespoke, very nice on paper third-rate ship of the line, but it turns out that in practice, when you've been out at sea for 3 or 4 weeks or a couple of months, maybe those choices weren't necessarily the best. An analogy I could draw in the modern day would be perhaps if you happen to live in a suburban environment, particularly over here in the UK, yes, you could buy a all-singing, all-dancing, nice low-to-the-ground BMW M5 or a Porsche 911 or a Lamborghini, whatever version they're up to these days. And yes, you'd look really cool and you'd look really fancy right up until you hit your first pothole or your first speed bump, and suddenly you're looking at, you know, a repair bill that's about the cost of a deposit on a fairly major house. Meanwhile, Joe Bloggs down the road, who's gone with, you know, a small SUV or a large saloon from a fairly basic or even mid-level manufacturer, is quite happily bobbing around up and down the same potholed and speed-humped roads every day and not really caring all that much because, hey, his car is actually better designed for the environment it's operating in as compared to Mr. £300,000 sports car who can, yes, you can absolutely beat him off the lights if you happen to find a bit of road that's suitable to do that. For what exact purpose? Yes, you have proven you are faster. Congratulations, that wasn't the competition. The competition was getting from A to B in comfort and, you know, perhaps actually having more than 3 pence left in your wallet after you finished all the repairs and the fuel bills. But never mind. Apply the same standard to ships at sea and suddenly you realise, well, yeah, maybe Britain can design ships. They can design ships that work in an actual operational environment for long-term naval operations, rather than being bespoke thoroughbred racehorses. And similarly to what we were talking about earlier with the French, supposedly not being able to fight, well, if Britain can't design ships and Britain is permanently sailing around with underdeveloped, underarmed, under-equipped vessels, what exactly does that say about Spain, France, the Netherlands, Germany, etc., etc., you know, all the people that the Royal Navy beat? If the Royal Navy is hampered with one hand behind its back by with a massively technologically inferior fleet and still manages to beat you, well, at that point, we're assuming that you have technological superiority and better designed ships. That must mean your sailors and your admirals and everything are completely and utterly incompetent and probably don't know the bow from the stern. Is that really what you want to imply about your own navies? And last on my list of propaganda that's kind of, if you like, broad national characteristic slander, rather than more specific examples, which we're going to get onto in a minute, you've got the Japanese and the Italians being technologically backward in World War II. And this largely seems to focus around the fact that, admittedly, the Germans and the Italians were somewhat lacking in the radar department for much of their involvement in the Second World War. And sometimes this can extend to other things like dual-purpose guns or self-sealing fuel tanks for Japanese aircraft or particularly modern aircraft in the Italians' case, etc., etc. But again, this is untrue both on a basic examination level and on a basic cognitive level. Because, yes, there were areas where both Japan and Italy were somewhat behind the Allies technologically in specific areas. There were also areas where Japan and Italy were ahead of the Allies in certain areas of naval technology. Japan, for example, torpedo-wise, as anyone who's ever heard of the word long lance will be aware, was very much ahead of, well, everybody when it came to big, powerful, rapid, long-range torpedoes for, well, pretty much the entirety of the war. The Japanese fell a little bit behind with things like homing torpedoes and so forth, but the Japanese torpedoes were undeniably very lethal all the way through the war. Torpex helped a bit to catch up with that, but the Allies still weren't fielding anything that was anywhere near as fast or as long range as a long lance and its derivatives, even by the end of World War II. The Italians had some of the best naval special forces in the world, and they also had some of the best optical-based fire control systems in the world. The Japanese optical fire control systems weren't that bad either. Now, yes, you can look at, you know, night fighting and stuff, which tends to involve the use of radar mostly, but even when it comes to night fighting, the Japanese, at the beginning of the war, had a distinct night fighting superiority with their low light equipment and other night fighting training against the US Navy, which, while it did have radar on some of its ships, completely lacked a night fighting doctrine. And so the Japanese, while they didn't have radar integrated across their fleet for night combat, they did have other technological devices, including, as I said, low light scopes and so forth, which the US Navy didn't have, and they incorporated them into their fleet in a far superior way. So whilst you could make an argument that in overall balance, the Allies held technological superiority in more areas than they didn't against the Japanese and the Italians, you can't dismiss either of those navies as technologically backward because they possessed technological superiority in some areas that were fairly important in naval combat and which obviously the Allies would struggle to overcome and in some cases didn't technically overcome during the entire war. Plus, of course, there's the same thing as with the French of, well, if, let's say, the Japanese are so technologically backwards, why did it take the most of the industrial might of the United States 4 years and two atomic bombs to finally get them to give in? That's not a power that's easy to fight. That's a power that's actually putting up quite a lot of a fight. And similarly with the Italians, if they're a technologically backward navy that you don't need to worry about, why exactly is the Royal Navy committing the single largest portion of its surface combat strength to directly counter the Regia Marina and committing a, relatively speaking, much smaller portion of its combat strength to combat the supposedly technologically superior Kriegsmarine? Look up the numbers. The forces that the Royal Navy keeps for the home fleet, just in case the Kriegsmarine comes out to play, compared to the numbers that the Royal Navy keeps in the Mediterranean, both in Force H and in Alexandria, in case the Regia Marina comes out to play, there's a very big difference in both numbers and types of vessels. Now getting on to some more specific examples. Another bit of propaganda you'll sometimes see people going on about is that US Navy anti-aircraft gunnery was superior to everybody else throughout the entirety of the Second World War. Now, this is a bit of a qualified one, because yes, it is entirely arguable, and indeed most people would agree with the fact that by the end of World War II, US Navy anti-aircraft gunnery was pretty much second to none. That was not the case in 1941 and 42, though. Through a combination of, well, they lacked experience because they hadn't been at war at that point, and also the fact that, simply put, a lot of US Navy anti-aircraft systems sucked in 1941 and 1942. The USN was actually quite behind a number of other navies in this department during that time period. Apart from anything else, the fact that Admiral King and his various subordinates and successors are desperately running around like headless chickens in the run-up to and immediately thereafter of December 7th, 1941, trying to massively improve the United States Navy's anti-aircraft capabilities, should tell you that even they didn't think the US Navy's AA capability was all that much to write home about. And then you look at the 1942 engagements. You have Enterprise routinely reporting that, yeah, the 5-inch 38 is a fantastic gun. The fire control systems to actually point it in the direction of the enemy are so appalling that we might as well not have the blasted things. And can we please improve them? You have various officers, including aboard Enterprise, but also just generally across the US fleet, essentially begging to have Oerlikon set up small 20mm gun factories aboard their ships to carpet every available square foot in additional 20mm, and then later Bofors 40mm once those start coming into service. And there's also practical results to look at. If you look at the major fleet carrier losses of the two big Allied navies in the Second World War, so this is, you know, full-size fleet carriers, both the Royal Navy and the US Navy lose four such vessels. The Royal Navy loses Eagle, Courageous, Glorious, and Ark Royal. Three of them are sunk by submarines, and one is sunk in a surface action, which isn't really much of a reflection on their anti-aircraft capability, but a vast number of the remainder of the Royal Navy's aircraft carriers come under repeated attack from absolutely massive numbers of enemy aircraft. We're talking about attacks that are 50 to 90 strong in some cases in a single wave and can add up to 200 to 300 individual attacks over the course of a day or two, which is actually a considerably larger number of attacks than you will face in your typical World War II Pacific carrier engagement. And yet, by hook or by crook, Britain doesn't lose a single carrier to air attack, except for HMS Hermes, which is a bit small. And at that point, you might as well hold the loss of USS Langley over the US Navy for all of that it's worth. But you flip over to the American losses, and they lose Lexington, Yorktown, Hornet, and Wasp. Now, Wasp, much like three of the British carriers, is sunk by a submarine. The other three are either outright sunk or disabled and left in a sinking condition, or in the case of Yorktown, mission killed and then finished off by a sub, by air attack. And if the US Navy's anti-aircraft guns were so superior, you would expect that, you know, the relatively speaking small numbers of attackers, we're talking about a couple of dozen maximum in any one attack, should be fairly easily able to be beaten off by your heavy, light, and medium AA guns. And yet they're not. The ships are taking hits. The ships are being sunk. And indeed, it is precisely this vulnerability that drives the aforementioned demands by the various US Navy carrier officers to say, we need more and better anti-aircraft guns, more and better anti-aircraft fire control systems, proximity fuses when they come in, more ships to mount more guns on, and strengthened fighter groups so that we can have more aircraft up on combat air patrol. All of this is an entirely sensible way of going about things when you have identified that actually, yeah, our anti-aircraft guns and gunnery is somewhat lacking. It's not a sensible thing to do if you've already got the best anti-aircraft system there ever has been or ever will be. And they build it into the best anti-aircraft system of the war, which is all credit to them. But the fact they had to build something tells you that they didn't have it in the first place. The penultimate example I would put forward is a more general one because it's present in a lot of different fields, and I'm sure many of you will be able to point out specific ones you've come across, and that is people taking something that has been traditionally given a fair degree, obviously not a massively overblown degree because that will require a bit of trimming, but a fair amount of importance in any given field of combat, obviously specifically naval combat, but that has lots of different subfields for our purposes. And they'll take that and they'll say, yes, well, you know, people have always said that, for example, the proximity fuse or the snorkel or the hunter-killer group, etc., etc. Yeah, well, people have said they're really important, but actually I'm going to show that they really weren't very important at all. In fact, if anything, they were neutral or possibly even slightly negative, and the whole thing's completely overblown. And this is a form of revisionism. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that historical revisionism is entirely a worthless field, because there are narratives that turn out with further research to be false, and there are times when certain things get massively overblown one way or the other, and they do need to be revised. But sometimes I think people look at fields and they, rather than do deep research into areas where perhaps there is a need for a bit more revision, they see that the the low-hanging fruit has already been addressed, and so they decide to take on random little canards, a lot of which do not actually have any real basis in, you know, needing any kind of pushback, or indeed any accuracy in significantly pushing back against the ascribed effectiveness or lack thereof. And for this, I'm just going to give a general example rather than a specific naval combat example, because it's an example that I actually personally find very annoying in my other historical interest of medieval combat. But I think it also serves to very neatly illustrate the point in terms of people who haven't really thought things through. And so my example is going to be the English longbow, specifically at Agincourt. So obviously, historically, you have the narrative of the English longbowmen being vital to the victory at Agincourt. And then you have this counter movement that says, oh, well, you know, longbows really weren't all that effective, and they couldn't go through enemy knight's armor. And really, actually, you would be perfectly safe if you were facing English longbows, so that this whole myth is completely overblown, so we need to consign them back to essentially being peasant troops. Apart from the fact that that last bit is completely wrong, longbowmen were not generally just randomly conscripted or levied peasants. A lot of them were actually professional soldiers, or the closest thing that you could get to professional soldiers at the time. That aside, yes, there have been tests, including the arrows versus armor tests, which I've been part of, which have shown that, yeah, a longbow arrow is not going to go blasting straight through the breastplate of a knight who has been able to afford good quality armor. But that is something that was already in the historical record from things like the Battle of Verneuil. What people have sometimes missed, specifically, especially from those arrows versus armor tests, is that there are weak points and gaps in the armor, and arrow hits to those areas absolutely will either compromise your ability to fight or just flat out kill you. And of course, not everyone on the battlefield was armored like the finest of French nobility. But more to the point, in the larger context of things, when you look at something like the Battle of Agincourt, the English army is known definitively to only have had about 700 to 800 knights or fully armored men present in their formation. The vast, vast majority of that army was made up of longbowmen. So, given that even by the lowest estimates, and that's a whole other revisionism thing of constantly trying to reduce the number of French troops at Agincourt, but even going by the very, very, very lowest of estimates, or should we say perhaps the lowest sane estimates, for the size of the French army at Agincourt, you're still talking about thousands upon thousands of knights and men-at-arms in the first wave who come in and fight the English. At which point, if the longbowmen are completely ineffective, we are supposed to believe that 700 to 800 English knights and men-at-arms fought 5, 6, 8, 10, or 12 to 1 odds in the first wave and won, and then went on to fight, you know, the second wave and won. And I'm sorry, but much as I love my 14th century Agincourt period armor plate, that does not make me a 14th century adept, or 15th century technically, adeptus astartes. You know, I cannot fight 10 other people or 5 other people in similar equipment, 5-on-1 or 10-on-1, and hope to survive if those other lot have even the slightest bit of combat training. It's just not going to happen. So unless you want to hypothesize that, I don't know, the Black Templars ported down with the majority of their chapter and outright replaced the English knights and men-at-arms at Agincourt, implying that the longbow is a useless weapon against armoured combatants, is basically making the English knights into superheroes, which is even more stupid, because they're not. Now, apply that lesson to all sorts of weapons and systems in the field of naval combat, and you can kind of get the point. You have to be very careful if you're going to severely denigrate one system that has that has historically been held to be pretty important. You have to make sure you're not by default, then implying absolutely superhuman, near magical levels of competence for some other system in order to get, you know, the actual historical result that we know happened. And the last point that I'm going to make is not so much about a specific example of propaganda, but more of a caution in that in the effort to counter propaganda, you have to be careful to not be as bad or worse as the people who are promoting the propaganda in the first place. In other words, don't let your counterswing end up sending the pendulum too far in the other direction. So if we were briefly going to go through the examples that we've just looked at, you know, yeah, don't make Captain Lindemann out to be a craven lunatic at the very end of an otherwise very solid naval career. Equally, don't make him out to be the paragon of excellence and the absolute most perfect naval commander ever. Absolutely push back against the idea that the Marine Nationale is incapable of fighting, but also don't, you know, try and promote the idea that the Marine Nationale was superior to everybody else at all times ever and only fell victim to luck and circumstance. Push back against the idea that the Germans were technologically superior in every way, but don't fall into the trap of then claiming that everything the Germans did was 15 years behind what the Allies could do. Yes, the British could in fact design competent ships, but it doesn't mean that every single British ship design was the best thing since sliced bread. Yes, obviously, point out that the Germans and the Italians were technologically ahead of the Allies in some respect, but then don't go on and say, oh, well, actually, they were ahead in almost all respects because they weren't. Again, similarly, point out that US anti-aircraft gunnery actually really wasn't all that good in 1942, but then don't pretend that it stayed terrible. You know, acknowledge when it improved and how it improved and that they were learning their lessons pretty quickly. Essentially, don't become the very thing you're seeking to destroy. And of course, that doesn't mean that people can't have different opinions and weigh the evidence in slightly different ways, because that's what historical analysis is all about. But there is a vast difference between looking at the same set of evidence and coming to a slightly different conclusion, or perhaps a somewhat radically different conclusion to other people, and being able to back that up with a full suite of evidence, than ignoring a whole bunch of evidence, cherry-picking a few sources, buying into some propaganda by people who are now long dead, and blowing up something as either massively inferior or massively superior in such a way that, you know, that a person with the critical thinking skills of a toddler can very quickly point out the absolute absurd implications of what you've just said. I'll conclude with another example drawn from my personal experience, the good old argument between katana and longsword. Oh boy, has that been an argument on the internet over the years. You know, starting off with the katana being the magical lightsaber in real life that could cut through anything, and the nightsword being a big, clunky, heavy thing that a katana would just smash through or just bypass completely, because the knight would barely have the sword up before the katana user had cut him into 16 separate components. And it swung back a little bit too far in some respects over the next few years on the internet, to the point where some people will tell you that a katana is basically a near useless, slightly sharpened iron bar, and the longsword is in fact the magical, you know, spring steel, all singing, all dancing weapon. I've fought both with a longsword and with a katana, against a longsword and against a katana in various HEMA practices, and it is an interesting matchup. They are two very different weapons. And yes, I would say that overall, the longsword is, in a 1v1 matchup, a slightly superior weapon. It has reach, it has two cutting edges, it's somewhat better at thrusting, but there are ways for someone who's a half-decent swordsman to take a katana and go, right, this thing does have some inherent advantages. It is a little bit faster. It does have the capability to win in a bind if you can get in close enough, because of the slightly greater stiffness of the blade and the way that the grip works out and so forth. And so you can use a katana to beat a longsword wielder in a fight. But you are going to have to work for it a lot more than if the situation was reversed. So you know, if someone said, which one do you want to face off against the other? I'm going to take the long sword all the time, but I'm also very well aware that if I'm up against a component who's a, you know, within a shouting distance of me, I've got, with a long sword, maybe a 60, 70% chance of winning. But there's still a significant non-zero chance that I might not win. And for the flip side, if I'm given the katana, yeah, okay, I'm at a disadvantage and I am going to have to work for it, but I can win. And so in the great longsword versus katana debate, my practical experience, admittedly, obviously this is HEMA, so it is blunted weapons. I'm not swinging sharp swords at other people and they're not swinging sharp swords at me, luckily. But within the realm of that experience, that my conclusion is, yeah, the longsword is a slightly better weapon, but it's not going to completely overwhelm the katana all the time, assuming that the katana user has a half-baked idea of what on earth they should be doing with their sword. And that is a much more nuanced idea of things than you'll see the vast majority of opinions displayed on the internet, where they will want one or the other to win 100% of the time. And similarly with this, don't fall for propaganda, don't become a propagandist yourself, and see through it and point out reasonably where the absurdities lie. And with that, thank you very much for listening to this sort of hour and a bit little mini rant, and we'll see you in another video.